Yeah, there's an uprising. People demanding a fully informed jury. We're talking about it with one of the advocates for that lawyer, PhD, criminologist, and also a civil libertarian, somebody who's standing up for the rights of the disenfranchised, people who are not the most powerful, and people who are accused of major crimes, who may or may not be getting a break from a jury. A jury has more rights than judges are inclined to instruct them about. And we're getting back to that coming up in just a minute on Coast to Coast, along with this question that was just tweeted to me, which I think is very interesting. Are you aware that in the U.S., you guys once more have debtor's prison? Folks are getting thrown in jail for unpaid debt. Google it. Well, I'll do one better than that, actually. I'll talk about it with Dr. Roger Roots next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. My sister-in-law, by the way, is a professor of tax law at Seton Hall. So I wonder whether she read your original article on about whether or not the police in the United States are constitutional. Dr. Roger Roots was talking about having done a constitutional search for any place in the Constitution that provided for police powers, and it's hard to find. In fact, you would, if we make a strict constructionist argument, I guess you would have to say, you'd have to conclude, Dr. Roots, that there isn't a place for a police force. There's a place for a sheriff, maybe, right? Or I mean, even there, is there, what's, who is the one that is supposed to be doing the prosecuting of the people, according to the Constitution, if it's not the police?
Well, actually, all of us, the original sort of framework was that all of us would be performing law enforcement duties. That was the original understanding. Many early prosecutions were privately prosecuted. In other words, it might happen that the victim of a crime would go to, for example, a grand jury and initiate criminal investigation. And it would be up to, the victim, or is it if the victim was gone, the victim's family sometimes would actually privately prosecute. Sometimes they would hire their own lawyer, to act as a prosecutor. Sometimes they'd do it themselves without lawyers. And we've completely lost track with that.
Yeah, totally. That sounds really foreign. But what about, so if the family did that, then who would do the arresting? Let's say they went to a grand jury and they said, this is this person killed our family member. They should be held responsible for that. Who went out and did the arresting?
Well, it could be done by a constable. It could be done by a sheriff. But often, the private citizen would make arrests. Keep in mind that the original conception of law enforcement was it placed the individual at he had the same exact lawful constitutional powers to enforce the laws as any government authority. So, for example, I can show you cases where someone who had been, well, let's just say someone who believed that someone had stolen some property from him would go to a magistrate or a judge, and he would get a search warrant. He would lay out probable cause under oath as required by the Fourth Amendment or the state level equivalents of the Fourth Amendment, and the judge would issue a search warrant. And the judge would sometimes issue it to the private citizen so that you would go, or you would have someone else go. Sometimes it was written, the warrant would be written such that, John Smith is hereby authorized to go and search, for this or that stolen property. Private citizens were originally intended to perform, citizens' arrests all the time. And most Americans in the early republic were actually well aware. They were actually fairly well educated about their legal rights and duties and responsibilities. There was such a thing where they called it the hue and cry. Sometimes when there was an extremely violent crime, such as a burglary or a robbery or something like that, especially a robbery, someone would yell out, "Hey, there's a criminal!" And they call it the hue and cry, and the whole sort of community would rush out to try to apprehend a fleeing felon, for example. You know, there's all kinds of stories like that.
It's probably easier back in a time like 1776, you know, probably easier back then than it would be to try to do that now. We would call that, I think a lot of people would call that vigilante justice, and there would be prosecutions for it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like I said, it's like night and day. And keep in mind also, if you read the writings of the founding fathers, they often talked about standing armies. And I make the point in that article that sometimes what they were talking, they were calling standing armies back then, if you really look at what they would be the equivalent of modern police forces. For example, the founding fathers were constantly angry that the British authorities had sort of occupied the city of Boston with all of these government troops on the streets. And they called it the standing army. There's a standing army, and there's no enemy anywhere. That you see these writings all over. Here we have an army in our midst, and there's not an enemy within 100 miles. And really what they are is they are an occupying force. And honestly, you look at today's New York Police Department or Boston Police Department, L.A. Police Department, it's identical to what the founding fathers would call a standing army.
I live near the Mall of America, and there was a fight. It turned out to be somewhat gang related, but there was a fight that got a lot of play in the news and on YouTube, and it broke out kind of this. I mean, there were some people that were scared and a couple of people that were hurt, but mostly it was chair throwing in one of the areas near right near actually the crepe stand that's there at the mall. So not fully the full food court, but in a little area in the main hallway where people sit and eat crepes, and there's ice cream and stuff. But I mean, there's suddenly been this like big chair throwing fight, and afterward they upped the security quite a bit at the Mall of America. Now they're already looking for guns. You're not allowed to bring guns in, and in a way, the fact that they were just chucking chairs at each other turned out to be pretty. You know, it was there was a few fists thrown, but it was. It wasn't, it, there was, at no point was it knives and guns, they don't think. But the police were there then in a much bigger force the next day, both private from the Mall of America security and from the local Bloomington police. And I found that an interesting reaction. I think it's a fair reaction that said, this is where the problem was, we're going to up our security. But some people had sent me messages saying afterward that it really did feel like suddenly the Mall of America was occupied. And I don't mean that in the Wall Street sense, that they were just everywhere on every, you know, corner in front of businesses. And that was an unusual feeling for people that they were getting used to. And others said, it's just like Europe. It's just like a lot of public spaces in other parts of the world where the reality means the reality is that people have to, there has to be an armed force there to stop something like that from happening to just say innocent shoppers. So I've been sort of wrestling with that a little bit, and maybe making a strong presence felt is enough to keep, you know, people from being able to rampage and being able to go on the attack. Maybe in the end we do have more peace because we have a higher, you know, visibility for the police department. But I realize the implications of that is it looks like we're under siege.
Yeah, we definitely have a much higher level of overall policing today in modern America than we've ever had before. And occasionally you'll see someone suggest otherwise. And it's absolutely not true. I've studied that question very closely. Never before have we had so many police per unit of population than we do right now.
Yeah.
And like I said, I believe the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, would be sort of spinning over in their graves.
Right.
I call it an occupation. Seems to me you can't hardly even. I live in the state of Montana, for God's sake. You can't even drive, you know, into Bozeman, Montana without seeing a cop. You know, it's just amazing, just the level of police presence we have now. Uh-huh. And I will say, the more we learn about security, you know, people do like to live in an ordered atmosphere, obviously.
Right.
As you mentioned, nobody wants to have chaos and hectic violence going on around them all the time. But by and large, private security forces I think, are so much more, let's just say, efficient at maintaining order and whatnot than public police are, with all the, you know, the yelling and the shouting and the, you know, the guns and the helicopters and all this, you know.
Pepper spray and tear gas and some of the other things which we've seen happen to people who just were sitting doing nothing. And we do see that.
And keep in mind that private security forces, generally, I mean, I'm speaking very generally, but they're generally trained not to be provocative, not to be aggressive. They are trained to protect the safety and the property of the place that they're, you know, positioned at. It's a different role from policing, which seems to be constantly sniffing and being very aggressive in the search for, you know, crime. And I think as a libertarian future, in my opinion, would be one in which we would rely much more on private security. It's much safer, much more, I think, settling and orderly than we would be relying on the system that we have now, with just so much aggressive law enforcement by police departments.
We're talking with Dr. Roger Roots. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. I have two questions that have been tweeted to me, and I want to get to them in just a second, but you bring up the civil libertarian piece again, and so I'll ask you, are there any presidential candidates whose views reflect that outlook on policing in the United States?
Well, actually, it's getting much better. Obviously, Ron Paul. I'm a big supporter of Ron Paul, although I am also active in the Libertarian Party, and Ron Paul, running as Republican. Ron Paul's views. He certainly wants to decriminalize the drugs and all of this, and he's
right.
Very much into de-escalating the war on our freedoms that is being waged right now on the streets. And so I definitely support Ron Paul. By the way, there's another candidate who's gotten some attention. That is Gary Johnson.
Yeah, I was going to say he seems more in line with what you're talking about.
Yeah, he had been the governor of New Mexico and had been a Republican. He has now formally and officially announced his intention to seek the Libertarian Party nomination for president. And he also shares a lot of views with Ron Paul, very much into not just, medical marijuana. You know, a lot of people are for medical marijuana, but only a true libertarian is for decriminalizing, you know, the sale and possession of drugs generally. And that would be my position, honestly. I think the people 100 years from now are going to look back on our period, and they'll just shake their heads. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, they're just going to wonder what went through our minds in this
right.
era, where we're putting people in prison for 10 and 20 and 30 years just for, you know, selling and possessing bags of powder and leaves and grasses. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, it's just so illogical.
Well, I'm with you on most things. On that, I really am, and I have been an advocate for many years, even before it was fashionable, to say that we need to get away from spending all of our resources, which we don't have. How fast might we start to balance some of these budgets that we have if we stopped putting so much effort in this failed war on drugs? I do think there's an aspect to drug enforcement. I don't know what the level is, but it seems to me more like what we do with alcohol. And I think that's a pretty good model, that there's a benefit to the, you know, by restricting it to a taxable quantity, that if you know, if people are going to drink, they're going to drink, and the if they're going to cause a problem, at least there's a benefit to society from that through taxation. If we're talking about drugs in that same way, I'm with you. That if somebody wants to ruin their life by getting drunk all day long, I'm not going to stop that. That's their right to waste their life if they want to. And I feel the same way about drugs. But I do hope that there was something on the other end that would come to society for some of the inevitable costs of that. Do you know what I mean by that? Or am I off base in the libertarian?
No, I certainly see where you're coming from. My take on it is, listen, 100 years ago, there were no that no criminal laws about, you know, possessing and selling cocaine and heroin. We know that many people, prominent people, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, for example, the author of the Sherlock Holmes novels, is known to have been a heroin addict. You know.
So was Sherlock Holmes.
Exactly.
No, he was. Do you know that?
No, I wasn't aware that the character was.
At the last line, you can check me on this, but I believe the last line in the novel, The Hound of Baskerville, The Hound of Baskerville, the last line, and it's in the original, I think it's in the original movie, the last line is Holmes turns to Watson and says, "Watson, to the needle."
Is that right?
Yeah, and he was a known, I believe it was opium, that he was using. But yeah, that was the that's how it was stipulated in the original Sherlock Holmes fiction. I could be wrong, but I think that's what it is. So yeah, I'm with you on that. But well, and I didn't mean to get you off track with that, but I thank you for reflecting on the political candidates that are out there. How about lawyers? If somebody's looking for an attorney that reflects your perspective, is there a way they can do that that's not hit or miss?
Well, you know, that is a very good question, and I've got to thinking about it. It is very difficult to find attorneys who, are very oriented toward aggressively defending cases. It's just hard to find what I would call libertarian lawyers or anti-government type attorneys. The problem with the bar and the bench today is that it is so overwhelmingly pro-government. I went to law school for 3 years, and what you find among generally, I'm really being very general. There's some, you know, there's, you know, liberals and there's conservatives, but by and large, most people who become lawyers view the state as a source of warmth and comfort in their lives. Very few have been shouted at by cops. They've rarely been beat up by cops. They're actually a little bit different than the general population in that way. And of course, the people who become judges are even more inclined to look at the state and government as a source of, you know, warmth and comfort.
Right.
It's very difficult. I tell people all the time, people call me up and I tell them all the time, listen, if you get charged with a serious crime, federal or state, you almost need to become a lawyer yourself. And, you know, it's really, that is the, you know, the Americans were very, very well educated in the law in the early republic. And there were many commentators reported, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville, many people in early America talked about how well educated and knowledgeable the average American was in the 1820s and 1830s about law. Most Americans were lawyers, or at least they could properly present themselves as lawyers in court.
I do talk radio. I think everybody else thinks they're a lawyer still to this day. But I know what you're saying, and I think maybe that's reflective of the judicial system, or the criminal system anyway, was simpler back then, maybe easier to follow than today with, you know, 100, almost 200 years of rulings since then. But let's get back to that idea, because I followed up on something that somebody tweeted me at Deacon Punnett on debtor prison and the return of debtor prison. They are right. It is back, and it's really scary. I'll read this to you coming up in just a minute on Coast to Coast. We're about a half hour away from taking y'all's calls coming up next hour, so hang on for that. We'll get to your calls on the way on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. There you go. The music of Sheriff. Yeah, kind of a stretch. But the sheriff system may be the only type of constitutionally allowed police system, as we're talking about with the civil libertarian Dr. Roger Roots. And then what about our constitutional rights? How far reaching has our government become through the judicial system to limit the scope of juries, which have a Fourth Amendment protection. And then, of course, that follows that not only should juries be instructed differently, but we should have the right to demand different as well. We are strangled, it would seem, in cases where juries might have felt free to even decide that somebody had been guilty of a crime and yet find them not guilty at the same time. That would be the jury's right, according to a strict interpretation of the Constitution. We're talking about that with Dr. Roger Rootes, and we'll get back to the implications of what that all means and how we can fight for a government that is more representative of the kind of jury system that we want next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. So, Dr. Roger Rootes, I looked the wiki up on it, but it's interesting. It said Sherlock Holmes occasionally uses addictive drugs, especially when lacking stimulating cases. He believes the use of cocaine stimulates his brain when it is not in use. He is a habitual user of cocaine, which he injects using a special syringe that he keeps in a leather case. That, according to the 7% solution, but that was not a Doyle book. That was written by my friend Nicholas Meyer. Holmes is also an occasional user of morphine, but expressed strong disapproval of visiting an opium den. And Dr. Watson strongly disapproved of Holmes's cocaine habit, describing it as the detective's only vice.
Wow.
So, yeah, there you go. Just a little background on Doyle as Holmes. Again, we're talking about the Fourth Amendment, strictly understood in the sense of the fully informed jury movement and the constitutionality even of a police department and some of our options there. Now, the question I posed to you is about how do you find that there's no known network of lawyers, of defense lawyers, who then that you keep in touch with fully informed jury association. There's no network of lawyers that somebody could tap into to find somebody that would represent them in the way that we're talking about.
Well, no, I wouldn't say no one network. People can contact FEJA, which they have the website there, www.feja.org. FIJA stands for Fully Informed Jury Association, FIJA.org, and they also have a 1-800 number, which is 1-800-TEL-JURY, T-E-L-1-L, T-E-L-JURY, T-E-L-J-U-R-Y, 1-800, that's a 1-800 number. And there are a couple of other organizations as well. I'm forgetting the group out of New York. Keep in mind, there's a very pretty good outfit called the, I can't remember the name actually, but
oh, don't worry about it.
Another organization out of New York that very liberal, has been, I believe during the McCarthy era, they were accused of being a communist front. But the truth is they do a lot of good work today about police brutality and that kind of thing.
All right.
So there are different organizations that have little networks of lawyers that sometimes could be summoned. Even the ACLU is worth contacting. They certainly know they can point people in the right direction.
Okay. The return of debtors' prison. This is going on. There's an article by Marie Diamond that was written less than a month ago and posted online that said that federal imprisonment for unpaid debt has been illegal in the U.S. since 1833. It's a practice people associate more with the age of Dickens than modern-day America. But as more Americans struggle to pay their bills in the wake of the recession, collection agencies are using harsher methods to get their money, ushering in a return of debtors' prison. It's increasingly common for people to serve jail time as a result of their debt because of, quote, sloppy, incomplete, or even false documentation. Many borrowers face jail time and don't even know they're being sued by creditors. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, generally, just in general, the world has become more let's just say, focused on criminal law as the remedy, the favorite remedy of all policymakers, it seems like. You know, policymakers. Keep in mind, 200 years ago, the average criminal penalty, believe it or not, was a fine. I mean, believe if you were convicted, for example,
right,
trespassing, breaking, and entering something, by and large, you could expect a fine. That would be the most common criminal penalty. You know, we didn't even really have prisons in this country until about starting around the 1830s, believe it or not.
Sure. No, I believe that.
You know, the most common penalty was a fine. Today, you know, there's an old phrase that says, if all you have is a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail.
Right. Well,
policymakers of today, the Congress and the state legislatures, have the criminal law at their disposal, and they have just declared so many things to be crimes. You know, I'm constantly reading about, you know, for example, just last week or 2 weeks ago, there was a story of the police went to go visit either a 5-year-old child or maybe it was an 8-year-old child to get overdue library books. You know, this kind of thing happens. I mean, listen, I've seen accounts where a guy who failed to turn in his videotapes back to Blockbuster Video when that existed was arrested.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, there are these kinds of things. And, you know, I can show stories that are just unbelievable.
That doesn't surprise me with Blockbuster. That's why nobody shed a tear when Blockbuster went out of business. They thought they were the police. You know, here's an interesting case in the story that this author stipulates, and that in one case, Sean Matthews, a homeless New Orleans construction worker, was incarcerated for 5 months for $498 of legal debt, while his jail time cost the city 6 times that much. So, you know, the taxpayers are picking up the bill, and it's a private debt.
Yeah.
So, I mean, no wonder. I mean, we're going to go broke doing that. I mean, that's not going to work.
Well,
so,
listen, in the economy as it is right now, for example, the state of California is in such a crisis with regard to overspending on the correctional system. I believe they've already announced massive, releases of prisoners in the California state prison system, and it's only going to get more so in the future, and not just in California but elsewhere. The jurisdictions are running out of money to hold all these inmates.
Right. Okay. We experienced some sort of major drop off there, right? It was we don't know what that problem was, but I'm sorry about that. So you heard a rather loud noise. I hope that isn't his phone knocking out for the receiving, because I know there's a million people that want to get through and talk about this when we go to the phones coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. But it's a good time for me to remind you, if you missed any of this show, you can go back and listen to it through Coast Insider. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, there's some great stories up there, one of which I wanted to get back to anyway, but I have a feeling we'll get Roger Roots back. But if you haven't had a chance to go and sign up for Coast Insider, and you can listen to the show anywhere, anytime, through various devices, once you're a member. Pretty economical to do it, too. CoastToCoastAM.com with more details. What was that noise? Did you hear it?
It might have been on my end. I'm managing this conversation by the means of two different chargeable handhelds. So I'm charging one while I talk on the other.
Well, here we go again. Uh-oh. That's not going to be a good noise.
No, I think the one I'm holding now is a little bit more charged.
Okay. All right. That's my warning shot that you're about to go. And I hear that noise, I get worried now. Well, thanks for hanging in there, and we'll give you a chance to recharge those coming up at the top of the hour before we get to more calls on the way on Coast to Coast. So we're talking about the fully informed jury system and about the laws that we could be getting the benefit of. And it being a fully informed jury, though, is our constitutional right, which a lot of people don't even know that they have. And so, you know, I got a tweet from John Henry who said, I'm a deputy in Texas. During our jury selection, they are advised of the punishment range and if they can consider the range. So doesn't that address what you're talking about, that they ask the potential jury, look, you know, this is the range of the potential penalties. Do you have a problem with this? Doesn't that address at least part of what you're talking about for the fully informed jury movement?
Well, I was not even aware of that in the state of Texas. And it, you know, that kind of thing, it often happens in death penalty cases as well. But usually the jury is really in the dark about sentencing. In death penalty cases, it has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court for a jury selection process to create a so-called death-qualified jury, which I think is abhorrent, really. But basically, they'll screen the jury in advance, and they'll ask for any potential juror to raise his hand if he's, you know, philosophically opposed to the death penalty. And if someone raises his hand, they'll toss him off the jury pool. And that I think, horrible process and practice has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, I wasn't aware of that that practice in Texas. The general practice, unfortunately, today is that jurors are really in the dark about the sentencing implications of their verdicts.
There's this new National Defense Act.
Yeah.
The NDAA that a lot of people are also tweeting me about, where Americans, at least on one interpretation, are no longer free or equal. President Barack Obama has signed this into law after originally opposing part of it, at least. This nullifies, doesn't this, I'll ask you this way, doesn't it nullify critical parts of the Constitution, this new NDAA?
Absolutely. This is I just call it the Bush-Obama administration, because ever since 9/11, it doesn't matter whether they're Republicans or Democrats, the policymakers in general in Washington have just been on this sort of national security fascistic sort of a fever in which they view, you know, the protection of the fatherland or the homeland as the primary purpose of government. And you know, you're seeing this kind of thing, you know, go on incrementally, but it's really been increased recently. And this National Defense Authorization Act that you're just talking about is just a major step. There are not many countries where you can be arrested without charge, without lawyer, without a jury trial, without any charge, actually, indefinitely. We are now in a very small group. We are with North Korea in terms of our status right now. And I know here in Montana, we do have a movement to recall the two U.S. senators and our one congressman who voted for that act, Senator Tester and Senator Baucus and Congressman Dennis Rayburg. There's a group called Oath Keepers you're probably familiar with. And that group has people in that organization generally have initiated recall petitioning. And in Montana, there is quite a push to try to get enough signatures to force an election to recall both Senators Tester and Baucus, as well as Congressman Rayburg. So, you know, I think there's a lot of pushback, and there's not enough education, but the word is getting out. I mean, if both houses of Congress and the president have signed a law that allows the American people to be arrested without charge, it's a brand new day for tyranny.
And it's an arrested on the basis that somebody is just accusing somebody of being a terrorist, that you can be arrested, right, by military police or so-called agents of the military, who can imprison somebody for the rest of their life,
yep,
without a trial,
yep,
and even take you out of the country to some place like Guantanamo. And you could be taken out of the country just because somebody says that guy is a terrorist and never, ever go in front of a judge.
And keep in mind, there is no standard for any screening or oversight on the executive branch claiming that someone is a terrorist. So you could be a, you could be anyone. You could be a janitor.
A talk show host.
Yeah, exactly. And there is no process to oversee or second guess or scrutinize that decision.
Yeah. This is, it is horrendous to think that this is, could be going on. And yet I'm going to, I offer this from my personal opinion. When the only voice you hear against it is the ACLU, and the only loud voice that came out against it, at least it is one that generally represents the far liberal side of our judicial activist community. If there aren't also equal voices from the right that join together to say, no, this one's too far, then I'm afraid the voice of the ACLU is just going to get lost in the cacophony of support for this. There has to be more legal organizations that are going to stand against it and say, this is wrong, or at least, you know, take it to the Supreme Court and have the Supreme Court say, no, this is wrong.
Yeah, it's we have gone so far down a road that I honestly, I never thought we'd get to the stage where we are right now. I mean, the problem is, honestly, the policymakers have learned the lesson that the voters do not punish them for being dictatorial and tyrannical in their criminal justice policymaking. And by and large, it's been true. The American public, the voters in general, have really been lackadaisical. They've been apathetic about these issues. And so politicians have sort of learned the lesson that they can just be fascists and tyrants and that they'll never lose an election. I just hope that's going to change in the near future. I really do.
And nobody wants to be perceived as soft on terrorism or soft on crime. That's become the horizon line for being a good American, is it, and then it goes up every year. Is how much this? No, I'm harder on crime. No, I'm harder on terrorism. I'm harder, and so everybody gets into this war of emotional escalation in order to prove some sort of point to the voters, which the voters seem to accept, at least until they're the ones being arrested based on somebody's accusation and scurried out of the country.
Yeah. It's really, we've reached a stage now where we're either going to have to turn it around or there is no turning back. I mean, it's just that we are, like I said, we are now with North Korea. We are with, Soviet era Russia, Nazi era Germany in terms of, our,
right.
Detainment, practices and policies that are on the books right now.
I agree. And ordinarily, I think the whole Nazi comparison usually is false. You know, it's usually a logical fallacy to say that. But in this case, I think you're right. You know, this is we enter into a kind of snitchocracy. It's a really scary time. It goes back to a kind of McCarthyism, too, which we all agree was not a good, that wasn't a good period for us. We shouldn't be going back there again, but it's been signed into law by this president, who very likely will be crutching on that during this upcoming election cycle. So it is then that we come to my part of the conversation. Now we throw open the phones for you too to talk with Dr. Roger Roots, the Fully Informed Jury Movement, reconsidering the Fourth Amendment and getting our rights back on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.